This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
Bonjour mes amis et bienvenue à cet épisode à Le Dernier Voix avec mon cher ami David Fitz.
Oh mon dieu!
I'm pretty sure we're going to have French listeners A, correcting the vocabulary and the pronunciation.
Duolingo has been serving you well, Kate McAvoy.
It's been a long 2 years, pal, as you well know. Your Swedish is much better than it was 2 years ago.
Vars are good.
So as you guys may recall from our previous episode and also from my slightly pathetic attempt at French, this week's film is Amélie. David, tell me, who is our guest? Who shall be joining us this week?
We have author extraordinaire and king of Twitter, I might say. He has an excellent level of contribution there, Caithin Leahy. Do you want to give us the lowdown on Caithin?
Good that you mentioned Twitter, because I've followed Caithin for a while, and he tweeted that he hadn't seen Amélie, and I had to jump in and be like, do not watch it, come on our podcast. Sometimes I do end up being a bit of a scary person in these. If I see someone mention that they haven't seen something,
your crowdsourcing is so commendable, Kate.
Yeah, I think it's really alarming, and like, it's now gotten to the point where, so one of our listeners and a pal of mine, Dylan, got on to me and said, James Kavanagh says he's never seen an Al Pacino film. And I was like, well,
we have Minions. Excellent. This is great news.
So we are working on the James Kavanagh thing, but I kind of like that it's now spreading. So it's like, and we do, listen, we are not proud. We'd love to hear any information. We like to hear from our listeners if there is a person they would like to have, if there's a film they'd like covered or whatever, like, please keep that information coming towards us. And David, to move slightly away from our cinematic pursuits, it was the most holy day in your calendar this week, Record Store Day. Tell the boys and girls what you got.
Well, unfortunately, yesterday was Record Store Day and I was bedbound. I woke up on Saturday morning with my 5:30 a.m. alarm set to go queuing at the crack of dawn.
I love you, you absolute lunatic.
Yeah, well, 5:30 is a little bit later. I was doing 3 a.m. before, but then realised no one else was as crazy as me, so I just pushed it a little bit later. So Record Store Day, there was a number on the list this year on my want list that I, thankfully, going into town today, which we're recording this on the Sunday, the day after, I managed to get everything that was on my list. So there was a Blur remix EP, Polly Saz album, Give You the Ghost, back from 2012, Taylor Swift single of The Lakes with an alternate version on a B-side. And then I also have ordered the Mel C album, Northern Star, from a Belgian record store because it completely sold out in Dublin.
Honestly, I do think there is a case we made that Mel C had the most underrated solo career of the Spice Girls.
Completely. And that the Northern Star album has I Turn to You, Never Be the Same Again.
Or IP, Left Eye, like, that is a great duet. That is a great song. Yeah.
What a song. I'm trying to remember if it has the Bryan Adams song as well. I know that was around.
I could be wrong. And yeah, please, both David and audience, tell me if I am. But I think that will be on his discography featuring her.
That would make sense, yeah. And because I know that they added 3 bonus tracks on the vinyl release, and they're mostly remixes. It doesn't include that one.
Which is a great song, I'm sorry. Like, I am not a big, like, Bryan Adams Summer of 69 or whatever, don't care for it. But Since You've Been Gone is a great song. You and I should do that at karaoke. I feel we could make that work.
That would be an excellent one for us, yeah. I will get rehearsing my Bryan bits. Or I can take Mel, whatever works.
with a voice like this, I tend to skew male.
Perfect. I'll get my altos.
Speaking of vocal stylings, I apologise if I am still a little bit husky. I wish I could say it's COVID. I am testing negative. It's that I was at a hen party at a drag brunch yesterday and I'm still like majorly in recovery.
Getting back to the world is hard, isn't it?
I had an absolutely great time. I will say I have, thank God, been feeling fine more or less for the past few days post-COVID, but I think I didn't really realise that I am probably still recovering and probably should pace myself a little bit more. You would actually, I think you would have enjoyed it. I mean, it was slightly feral because it was a basement bar, Tonight Josephine, that was full of hen parties. But it was a pop icons brunch. So we had Beyonce, Britney and Gaga. So that was really, really fun. Man, some of those drag queens are athletes. I was just like, how are you doing what you're doing with your body? And I know the surprise thread really that has run through so much of this series is us discussing different traditions of drag. So the like MC compare drag queen was really more kind of reminded me of the Vivian, like that kind of vibe. And I love like a grand dam MC kind of vibe. I'm really into that or whatever. Someone who will like, I'm fucking knackered and I'll tell a few jokes. You know, I'm really into that. So that was really good fun. But yeah, by 10:30, I'd had a couple of pints of water, but I was just like, no, we did start at 3:30 at the drag brunch and then we went on. And then by 10:30, I was like, no, I'm not 21 anymore. And I'm going to hop in an Uber and go home. And then today has very much been a chillaxing. I have finally, and I am confident you haven't seen this because it is tangentially sports related, but other than you, I am probably the last one to see Drive to Survive. So we have started watching that. It's a Formula One documentary series on Netflix.
The fact that this wasn't even on my radar. No, I definitely haven't seen it.
David, I mean, I think you will quite like it because every man in it is a diva, is what I'm getting out of this.
Into it.
It is really interesting. I had heard that they have made a similar documentary series shooting at the Australian Open in tennis. So like I'm Ooh. Gagging for that. And it was the whole Djokovic anti-vax getting kicked out of Australia thing.
Yeah.
It was Nadal equaling the record of Grand Slams and like winning his first Grand Slam in years. It was Ash Barty being the first Australian woman in decades and the first Australian to win in the Australian Open. So it like I'd say the goss will be 90. So yeah, looking forward to that should it materialize. But speaking of Netflix, very interesting to see 200,000 drop in their subscribers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I've been reading, like, they've already started shutting down some, especially their in-house animation projects. There was an adaptation of Roald Dahl's The Twits that was going to be coming that is now taken off the cards.
Well, kind of good, because that's not really my favourite Roald Dahl. I have to say The Twits doesn't really do it for me.
Has it ever been done?
I think it's quite tricky because they're so horrible and gross.
Animated kind of would work for it, yeah. But in terms of those subscriber count going down so much, 200,000 globally doesn't seem like a massive number to me for the scale of...
I think part of the issue, like as we mentioned before, subscribership massively boomed during lockdowns. There's always going to be a slight step back or boomerang effect or whatever. But the other thing is, you know, Apple TV are obviously part of Apple. Disney have Disney. Netflix have no other, to be a bit Warren Buffett about it. They can't diversify their income stream. They are just a streaming service.
Yeah, and I've heard that they launched that thing of like the mobile games and they weren't really well received at all. There's a series of things. If you open up the Netflix app, it'll offer you games you can download, but you only use if you're a Netflix subscriber. And I think they wanted that to be a bigger thing, like Netflix for gaming, but it just hasn't had the audience uptake.
And also, like, I think the quality of what is the programming on Netflix for me is deteriorating. Mm. And then there is also then the discussion of they obviously tend to exclusively dump all episodes where like your Disney's, let's say with Moon Knight and even, let's say WandaVision is probably the first time it was super successful of like, and you're dominating the conversation then for whatever, 6 weeks, a month, 2 months or whatever. So yeah, I think it is interesting to consider something like that. I don't think ads would be the way to go. I've seen them discussing that. Mm. And then yeah, as someone whose various streaming subscriptions prop up her entire family, I'm not entirely sure how you would police that because I think that was part of their thing.
So it's interesting. I did see something online about some users in the US have already started receiving, like they're clearly testing out new models for enforcing the password sharing. So what they're doing it on the basis of is if they're seeing consistently a multiple IP address login coming from two different locations, then the person will get a notification saying, would you like to add another person to your account for $3.50? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be like a premium to have a shared account,
yeah,
but not shutting down accounts that are doing that. It's mm-hmm. more, you can't run this logging in from multiple locations on an ongoing basis.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Speaking of another streaming service, I'm having this very niggly issue. And if anybody else has had it, let me know. We've been trying to watch, what is it, Die Another Day? No, not Die Another Day. What's the most recent Bond?
No Time to Die.
No Time to Die. That one. I was looking at something about dying. He's always dying.
Die.
You only live twice, whatever. I got the email that you get like every Friday or whatever from Amazon Prime. And we were like, lovely, we'll watch that. We'll have a cheese board. Because Steve was also still testing positive from COVID. So just trying to have like a nice, you know, Friday in or whatever. And we have a smart TV, as I think most people do at this stage. And I also have like an Apple TV from when I, before I lived with Steve. And on neither of those apps could we get the film. But we could, like, if I logged in on my laptop, you know, it was there.
And it was specifically that film and not other ones?
Yeah, it was it wasn't available, which is very confusing because you're getting, I have repeatedly gotten emails from Prime being like, hey, you can watch this. So that was very confusing. But we did watch George Lazenby's one outing as Bond on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I have got to say, I do not know why this man, now obviously he chose not to make more Bond films, but he is, for a man who was an Australian model, he is really good.
He killed it.
He's very handsome, but he also has, Bond is not a nice person. And he has that kind of, and obviously there's a bit too much hitting of women, but also a shout out for, I think, a strong contender for possibly my favourite Bond girl, the incomparable RIP Dame Diana Rigg, who we also probably most recently remember as the Queen of Thorns from Game of Thrones, and her immortal "Tell Cersei I want her to know it was me." So she marries Bond, and you are kind of like, I mean, well, quite right. She's amazing. She's beautiful. She's funny. Well, quite frankly, James, you're punching here. Yeah, that was really enjoyable. The plot is absolutely deranged, obviously, and there's like an excessive amount of skiing. I just don't think there's.
I was going to say that's a ski one, isn't it? Yeah, I love that.
It's not a ski one, as in there was another one where, which is very winter sportsy, and the Bond girl who is deeply annoying is like a figure skater, but there is a lot of skiing. Also, Telly Savalas, who's best known as Kojak, is playing Blofeld, which is also very confusing. The plot is insane. He brainwashes loads of beautiful women as like sleeper assassins.
That's, I feel, very Austin Powers, what it drew from kind of thing.
It is that kind of era. And I think like it is easy to forget that like GoldenEye and then moving into the Daniel Craig era after that kind of reimagined Bond as this sort of grittier.
Oh, that was a reboot, yeah.
And like I think it started with Pierce Brosnan, and then Roger Moore had just gotten so absolutely insanely ridiculous. And obviously, I think you can't ignore the influence of the success of the Bourne films on the direction that James Bond had taken. But as Steve said, I like the old ones, and he's right, because like they are obviously nuts, but there is something very, very enjoyable about the majority of them. Like sometimes the ones where like Roger Moore is like old enough to be the grandfather of the women gets a bit weird, you know. And then like Moonraker, obviously like Bond doesn't need to go to space. Bond should definitely never be in space. But yeah, it was interesting to revisit like one of the older ones. And I had, like I said, I'd never seen Lazenby, and I thought he was great. And there was like a lot to, and I think it's actually, my understanding is, because we were doing a little bit of reading afterwards, it's one of the like Bond purists' favorite Bond, or it's one of those ones that I think at the time was slated a bit, but now people really enjoy it. And I think they have pretty much all the Bonds now on Amazon Prime. So,
oh, nice.
And also, if anyone would like to come on the podcast and talk about a Bond, I think it would be really interesting. Pick a Bond, any Bond. It would be a really interesting one to talk about. I'm a big fan of You Only Live Twice, but it is actually quite racist because he does do yellow face, where at one point he's like pretending to be an Asian person.
Oh, no.
Like, it's not quite Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, but it's not great.
No.
And also, like, the idea, like, he's still blatantly, obviously, Sean Connery. So you're kind of like, this is funny. But yeah, would recommend that. And then we also watched Skyfall, which I do think is really, really good.
Oh, is that the Andrew Scott villain one? That's Spectre, isn't it?
Yeah, Skyfall is the one with Javier Bardem.
Yes, exactly.
And it's very homoerotic. And it's Judi Dench's last outing as M, which is really enjoyable. Albert Finney turns up as like the least Scottish man. But I think, and I mentioned this on Twitter, and people seem to agree with me, so the thing I like about Skyfall is it has so the last, I don't know, maybe like third of the film or whatever is in Bond's old family home, which is like an old Scottish, I don't say farmhouse, but like manor house. That's the word I'm looking for, not farmhouse, because it is fancy. It has a really strong atmosphere and sense of place. Whereas sometimes I know, obviously, when you watch a Bond, you want like Monte Carlo, you want, you know, Burma, you want whatever. Yeah. Apologies, Myanmar. But you want a globetrotting element. But sometimes I think it all just blurs into one and you don't feel like any kind of sense of place. And I think that was one thing in terms of atmosphere that Skyfall did really well. And also like Judi Dench is like my favorite M. I think she was amazing. And there is like, you're kind of digging into like Bond's past and childhood a little bit as well. Javier Bardem's having a great time. There are some really good set pieces, but also like for me, and it's probably part of the reason that The Winter Soldier is one of my favorite Marvels, is like and it was what I would have liked them to have done with Black Widow. Skyfall, it's stripped right back because they're in like a last chance saloon kind of standoff. And I think that kind of thing is always really strong for character, but also makes you feel like there are actual stakes. Because I think with the evolution of some of the Marvel films, you never think anything bad's actually going to happen to anyone, you know?
Exactly. It's just, how are they going to vanquish this next thing? Yeah.
Even so, there's no sense of peril or jeopardy, which there actually is in Skyfall. And again, like there is a significant death as well. So yeah, I think that that really pays off. So yeah, we've been dipping into. I definitely want to revisit GoldenEye because I do actually think Sean Bean is one of the best Bond films. And again, there's an actual story, there's an actual jeopardy, there's an actual existing relationship.
And possibly the greatest video game of all time was made from it. So
yeah, like as someone who's not even a gamer, even I have played GoldenEye, and that like particular look and feel.
Yeah.
There is a French rugby player called Antoine Dupont who I do think looks like he was rendered in GoldenEye.
Ooh.
Now he is also the best rugby player in the world, so it's clearly not holding him back in any capacity. But there's a very specific look and feel to it as well.
Yeah, the blocky head kind of thing.
Exactly. So, David, to pivot away from me and my ongoing relationship with James Bond, what have you been seeing?
So there's been a few I've watched movies-wise. Fresh, the one with J.D. Edgar Jones and Sebastian Stan, that's on Disney+.
What did you... Because I think he's gas. Like, he's very... Much like Chris Hemsworth, no right to be that funny for that handsome.
It's an interesting character for him because he gets a little bit of variety to play with throughout the course of the movie. I really don't want to spoil too much because there's a brilliant twist in the film. What I will describe it as, it's kind of like a Get Out for women dating on online apps kind of thing.
I mean, sold.
Yeah.
That works for me.
So I will leave it at that and recommend that as a, like, get out there and watch it. And yeah, it's surprising. It's a bit shocking. It's a bit gory, maybe for you, Kate. I don't know.
I like the way you're like, you know, I love and respect you, but you are a wuss.
Yeah, but just bear that in mind going into it, that you may have to expose yourself to some gore. Another Disney Plus one I watched was Turning Red, which was the movie about a red panda and shame. So I thought I'd be all over it, given my obsession with the animals and constant experience of the emotion. But I will admit I was a little bit underwhelmed by it. I feel sometimes with some of the newer Disney Pixar ones, they're not winning me over in the same way that the childhood ones are. And I don't know, is that just me getting old or is the quality actually waning?
So stick with me. It's going to sound like I'm pivoting, but it is tying in what you're saying. We're all aware of Wordle. But as you know, there's about a million spin-off of Wordles. And one of them is one where it shows you a film in 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. And you have until 6 seconds to guess what it is. And today's one was Wall-E. And I just think with Up and Wall-E, like, obviously you have, you know, the initial Toy Story and whatever, amazing. But then I think with Up, in terms of the emotional resonance, like it was when Pixar, for me, it was the most consistent movie studio in the world. The films just happened to be animated.
Mm.
And so I just think it is quite hard to live up to that peak. And then maybe Inside Out. But even then, for me, I just think the double whammy of Up and Wall-E are incredible films.
Yeah, I was just about to say, Inside Out, I liked. And I think the thing that the thread that I can see in the Pixar movies that I really enjoyed tended to be like the non-human ones. That, like, it was about toys coming to life. It was about a robot. It was about, like, the weird little emotions controlling you inside your head. But, like, the likes of Encanto, the likes of Turning Red, there was a very, like, human story element to it.
But I will say the flip side is, for me, like, Up is probably the best Pixar film. And that is even that infamous first, like, 10 minutes, you know, thing that covers an entire life and life of a relationship and is wordless and, you know, reduced as I did cry in the first, like, 10 minutes of that film, as I think a lot of people did. That is probably, and I know you have the balloon house and the weird bird and the talking dog, but it is probably the most human film in a lot of, maybe until the, what's it called again, Red Panda film.
Turning Red. Yeah.
So no, I think it is interesting. I will definitely see it. It's on the list of things to see. But I know because it was actually on my mind today because we had done that. And then there's another one as well, which is like Frame It, which is frames from films.
Yeah, I've done that one before, but it's just like single shots as opposed to video. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think you get up to six of them. But yeah, they're good. For, like, I am not really a regular, other than Duolingo, which is, you know, work, not fun. But yeah, Steve has about 10 million of them on the go at the moment. Like, you know, countries.
What's the other, Hurdle is the other one that I've been using. It's the music one where they play like 6 second intros to tracks. And 6 seconds at the very beginning can sometimes be tough because like there can be noise or sound effects before the song breaks in.
This ties into the drag brunch because we did do a Pop Icons round, which was like the intros of various Britney, Lady Gaga, Beyonce tracks. I only got 8 out of 10, which disappointed me because I am an idiot and didn't realise it was only the Holy Trinity ladies. And I thought the start of Britney's Sometimes sounds quite like Backstreet Boys' As Long As You Love Me.
Very much. And I believe both were produced by Max Martin, so that would make sense.
I mean, I'm so glad you're here.
Fact-checking myself here with an edit. The Britney song was not produced by Max Martin, but it was recorded in the same studio in Stockholm in Sweden that the Backstreet Boys recorded As Long As You Love Me with Max Martin. So it has a Swedish connection, but not Max.
I can't remember what the... Oh, actually, no, the other one was very annoying because I put down Poker Face instead of Love Game, which is actually a terrible error on my behalf.
Same album? I'll give you a little benefit of the doubt there, but...
Yeah, I know, but, like, you know, we hold ourselves to higher... Like, I'll let the Britney Backstreet Boys, other than me being a moron and being like, it is clearly songs from these three artists, the theme of the brunch, you fool. But I was annoyed with myself about... Like, I apologise. Stephanie Germanotta, you will always be famous. But, yeah, that was poor.
In terms of the other ones that I've watched, in keeping in the theme of things that are gay, two of them, I watched Q-Force on Netflix. That was like, it came out last September and it's an animated show. A lot of animation going on in my watches recently, but it's about a team of queer secret agents, and the lead voice cast was the guy who played Jack on Will and Grace, Sean Hayes.
Oh, yes.
And there's a few other names like Wanda Sykes, Jane Lynch, Matt Rogers all kind of pop up throughout it. And that was, yeah, just fun, brainless, entertaining watch. And then the emotional watch that I did this weekend was Heartstopper, which was adapted from Alice Osman's graphic novel, which I read a few years ago. And it's about a teenage queer romance between two school kids. And it's very sweet. It's very lovely.
I am hearing raves about this from the gays of Twitter.
There's a lot of the my age gays who are kind of like, I have left watching it feeling a little bit hollow because it's kind of shown me what could have been.
That you could have had a very different adolescence experience.
Yeah.
And it's tricky. Like, it's like anything, you know, Gen Z and whoever's coming next, God love them. The future belongs to them. I think they're great. But it does, I think, and we've talked about this before in terms of like the weird sexualization of women in the like in the 90s and 2000s. And I think it's the same to a certain extent with gay people, not to speak over. But we were all being told, hey, we're this free society. And, hey, and you know, in Ireland, that's like now gay marriage is amazing. But that didn't stop the tragic deaths of two queer men and the serious injury of one in Sligo and one in Dublin. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's this idea of we were sold that, you know, whether as a woman or a queer person, that this whole like, you know, everything's hip and cool now, guys. But I do think a lot of the homophobia, misogyny or whatever was almost sneakier. It was almost more covert.
I think like it's that thing of we've evolved from tolerance to a bit more integration in society, but we're not at full integrated in that sense of that, like it's seamless kind of thing of that. There are still so many aspects where there are still kind of disadvantages or struggles to living openly gay. And yeah, I think just shows like that just give a very hopeful message to a younger audience. So very, very happy to see it.
We contain multitudes, and I think it is possible and acceptable to be like, this is beautiful. I'm really happy for the baby gays, but God, I wish it had been a bit easier for me. I think you're allowed to think both of those things at once, you know, and nor do they contradict each other. They would go together.
Yeah, yeah. And my last watch I will recommend is Shining Veil, which is the new one from the mind of Sharon Horgan. Courtney Cox and Greg Kinnear are the two leads. They're a couple who moved to what they quickly come to find out is a haunted house after Courtney Cox's character had like an infidelity when they were living in the city before. And what I would say about it is it has a very American Horror Story feel, even just like the plot and the way that they're kind of doing this haunted house type thing. But way less gore, so you'd be happy with this one, Kate. And Sharon Horgan's humor is injected in really like short little jabs kind of in ways. It still has like the feeling of a horror or a suspenseful show, but then her humor picks it up with a little bit of lightness. So I'm enjoying that. I got like halfway through the 8 episodes so far, and we'll be picking that up during the week. So yeah, I think that wraps up what I've been watching.
Sounds like you've been having like a really broad experience, and I'm like, I'm watching old James Bond films and Formula One documentaries. But listen, as we said, we contain multitudes, both emotionally and culturally.
Always.
And so as the news breaks on my phone that it looks like, thanks be to God, Macron has been returned as the president of France and not a fascist.
What a week to celebrate.
Yeah, I know. Shall we take the time to pivot into the Francophone and Francophile world and look at Amélie? Cian, thanks a million for joining us. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
So I suppose first things first, the reason that you are on this podcast, God love you, is because you tweeted, Amélie's 20 years old today, I've never seen it. And I decided to sweep in and be like, no, don't watch it. We want to talk to you about it. And we usually ask last, what do you think this film is about? But you had an incredible guess as to what Amélie might be like. You drew a very interesting parallel. I was wondering if you could remember what it was.
If I remember my tweet correctly, I said it would be, I imagined it would be like Paddington, except with a Parisian human instead of a Peruvian bear.
Yeah, well, I think that's love it. You can see why I was like, we must speak with this man.
You definitely hit on something with the trend of food, because Paddington and his love of the marmalade sandwich, there is definitely a food element with this film. And also, Kate, I'm kind of surprised that we haven't had as much of a food-oriented movie in the selection so far. So I'm delighted to tuck into this one.
Someone's been working on that. Yeah, food is pretty much mine and David's raison d'etre, as I think, you know, to try and be a francophone about it, as it is for most people. So yes, that is a very good point. So in terms of circling back a little bit further, even further indeed, to 20 years ago, why didn't you see this movie when it first came out? Was it under your radar, or what was the story?
I was thinking about this. So I would have been about 15 at the time, which I feel like would have been my peak, you know, teenage pretension, where like if being subtitled would have been good, but it seemed so sweet and like sickly, like all the ads are like, it was bright and things like that, because it's like I know the director Jean-Pierre
Jeunet,
yeah, so I had seen like Alien Resurrection, and I think he had City of Lost Children, I think, and stuff like that, which were like the kind of things I watched when I was a pretentious 15-year-old. But I was like, no, this looks, it just kind of felt like the kind of thing I at the time just would have stayed far away from.
In school, did you do French?
No, I did German, was the one I did.
Yeah, because I feel like for a lot of people, this was the like excuse movie that they could get away with watching. It's like, yeah, Mom, I'm studying.
I watched Run Lola Run.
Also a banger, and from memory, quite short. We're a big fan of like a brief 90-minute film. As far as I remember, pretty much tying in exactly what David says, I think we saw this, we went to see this as part of transition year French class, I think, which was the type of thing that I'm sure teachers were like, oh, thank God, to try and fill that weird, like, murky thing of transition year where you're still meant to be educated, but also there's meant to be some sort of fun element of it or whatever. And then I did French as a minor with my degree. So I am pretty sure we were also, I just was actually surprised when I saw your tweet that it was 20 years old, because I kind of think I really associate it with being in college, because I feel like it was one where you were, if you were kooky, you had your poster of it on the wall as well. So I kind of feel like it's been, I associate it more with college, which would have probably been like 5 years after it came out.
I do think it's funny though, like with so many of these things coming up recently about anniversaries of release dates, I always would love to see if there's like actual record of when it was first shown in Ireland or released in Ireland, because I have distinct memories. Now this is in like a different genre of film for sure, but Bring It On didn't come out in Irish cinemas for a year and a half after it came out in America, and I was dying to see it because I was like a Buffy stan at the time, and seeing Elijah Dushku was like moving from the TV into the film world, I was like, need to see this. I was like literally to the point of like pestering cinema staff, like, have you heard anything? Do you know when it's gonna be out? So yeah, the 20 years, it could have been less for Ireland, who knows.
We had like a local art house cinema, the Kino, and I kind of just went to see anything in there, because there was one point, like, this is the, I guess, my scale of being, when I started being kind of like, I'm going to watch all the art house films or something like that. So I remember seeing the Royal Tenenbaums. And then after that, I was like, I'm not going to watch trash in the normal cinema. I'm going to go watch Donnie Darko and all these other sophisticated.
And it's going to be my entire identity.
Until I watched one movie, which I really, really hated. And I was like, oh no, there's bad art house films too.
Yeah, it's always such a crushing realization, isn't it? Where it's like, this amazing thing I've found, oh, not everything about it is fantastic. And especially as you say, at that stage in your life where you kind of pin parts of your identity on something being really cool, and then when you see something about it that's not, you're like, oh well, on to the next thing. Although clearly your love of film has stayed with you. I know we're quite biased, guys, because obviously we're all in around the same age bracket, but it really was like a great time for movies, and it really was a time, I think, where things like Donnie Darko and Amélie and whatever that would have been, as we say, independent or arthouse cinema really did kind of make that transition over into the mainstream, because, you know, angsty teens like us were like, yes, I must go and see this. And it was also available to us as well, which is nice. So, you know, it was, the stuff was hitting Irish cinemas.
And it's that funny thing even of like streaming now, and I know I don't want to be the guy who's like every episode ranting about like, oh, streaming is changing everything. But like, there's a brilliant aspect of it democratizes, and there's a brilliant access that you now have to see way more stuff. But what actually kind of jumps out and has the kind of success, like Emily, I was just looking it up there, has like it's credited as possibly one of the most successful French international releases ever. And kind of the potential for something like that to happen now, I wonder whether it would be something that, like, if it got released on Netflix, has like a blip for a couple of months where there's buzz, maybe Oscar contender for that year, but doesn't have like the legacy maybe that this does, where it, you know, it's being adapted into a stage musical, Broadway and everything, like that level of movie.
I think if you're not a Squid Game, it's quite, and which is, and I think it's easy to forget, is like, you know, the one in a million, or if you're a Tiger King or whatever. Like, I think it is easy to forget the sheer volume of stuff that goes onto streaming. And it might be good. It's not necessarily just about, but there's something about when it hits a certain zeitgeist and then it becomes the thing that everybody has seen. Whereas Emily kind of seemed to achieve that in a pre-streaming sense. I feel like if you said to almost anyone, name a French film, I don't think you're going to get that many people saying Les Règles du Jeu. Maybe Le Hen or whatever. But I think Emily would be the answer 9 times out of 10 that you're going to get back.
Actually, one of the things that the Netflix thing reminds me of for like Emily, which I'm kind of looking forward to seeing, is just like, obviously it's very like visually resplendent is what I'm getting the impression. While a lot of Netflix films tend to be like visually quite flat. Like, I remember hearing a thing, this is possibly me repeating purely speculative stuff, but that there's these kind of guidelines for people making films that are made directly for Netflix, that theoretically you should be able to get the same amount of visual information whether you're watching it on a big screen or on your phone.
I know from previous working life, working in the kind of streaming video world, Netflix have this approach of very data-driven how they kind of make everything. So they'll use viewing data figures and like what scenes there was drop off or what like caused people to like end their viewing cycle, and they're using that to like feed back into the filmmaking process, which I think is like on one hand fascinating and like evolution of the way the content's being driven to keep it stimulating, but how artificial it is and whether we're really just getting machine generated AI stories at this point and we don't know it.
I watched He's All That recently. That's definitely not written by a human.
And we touched on it a little bit there, as you mentioned, with your stunning Paddington reference. Also, if anyone wants to come on the pod and talk about either Paddington or Paddington 2, please hit us up, because I mean, I would do that happily at any time anyway. And also that about kind of the idea that it's a very visually rich film. Like, what do you know about this film? What have you picked up? And I get the impression that you're almost slightly surprised at yourself that you haven't seen it.
Yeah, I guess it was one of those things where, you know, there's certain movies that you kind of assume at some point you'll end up watching it. Like, the one I would have done had this podcast existed 2 years ago was that I hadn't seen Titanic. But then there was just one day I was sick in bed and watched it. I was like, oh.
When you need to like do very little for 3+ hours, I think it is a very solid choice. Yeah, well, hopefully, again, I don't want to be shilling too hard for future episodes, but yeah, again, if anyone wants to come on board and talk about Titanic, oh, on board, guys.
Hey.
It would have worked out pretty well. No, I do think there is something about Amélie that, like we said, it's almost shorthand for a French film that you almost feel like you've seen it even if you haven't. You're like, yeah, that girl.
Yeah, I was actually trying to think about when I first saw this, and I know that the film came on my radar via the soundtrack. I played the piano and I didn't like the prescribed like classical music stuff that was in like the Royal Irish Academy books of like the grades and everything. So film soundtracks or that kind of thing, I'd always try and like get them as a substitute and encourage my music teacher to let me play them instead of all the classical stuff. And I had a book of, it was like a selection of all different movie soundtrack ones, and like the theme tune to Amélie was in it. So I think the first time I heard it was my music teacher playing the sheet music of the theme tune to the movie.
I had no idea how many parts of life Amélie truly has, of like being a teenager in Ireland. You're like playing the piano, you're doing French or in school, possibly, that it had sneakily permeated.
So the things I know about it, I know, obviously, Audrey Tautou. And then I also remember, was there, because I know one thing that happens in it, although this might be me completely incorrect and someone told me, because there's a thing with gnomes and photographs. But I remember that being like a mobile phone ad for Vodafone or something like that. So I think, I'm imagining some, this will turn up in it. Although this is now, I'll probably listen back to this later and now go like, what, where do they get gnomes?
That's the joy. I live in hope of people being, you know, oh yeah, the Seven Samurai, Kate Moss was really good in that, or something just absolutely wild, and that David and I go, and then they go away and watch it. You know, I think Audrey, I remember she, I believe she was in The Da Vinci Code with Tom Hanks and Tom Hanks' disturbing wig, in terms of like a crossover. And then I like to think she made that film and was like, screw this, I'm going back to France. And that was it. I'm assuming that The Da Vinci Code just broke her and she was like, no, thank you.
I remember watching a movie with her and it's called He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not, which I remember was being pitched as like the dark underbelly of Emily. And... but obviously I hadn't seen the light overbelly.
If you will, yes.
So I'll be able to watch this and go like, I'll be the one person that goes like, oh wow, so this is, He Loves Me, Loves Me Not in a different form.
Yeah, actually, I have a memory of seeing A Very Long Engagement in transition year, and that being my pretentious like, oh, I'm going to see a very sophisticated French movie viewing kind of thing.
Yeah, I also saw that. I think I enjoyed it, but I think it is well named because I remember it being extremely long.
Yeah, if in my head, for some reason, I'm thinking like French Atonement. I remember the movie being good, but that's like...
yeah, it's a vibe, yeah, and World War One's fluttering about.
My main memory is that Jodie Foster is a very good French in it. It was like her and Kirsten Scott Thomas were the ones that always turned up in like French films. So it was like, oh, wait a minute. She just naturally, yeah, she slips into it when telling a fun anecdote about meeting the ambassador.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And yeah, makes you realize that you are indeed a plebeian, but she's very nice about it. Listen, I think we might park it there because as we say, the fear is always the more we talk about it, just the more we give away about the film. And we definitely want to have you go in with untarnished by mine and David's opinions on Amelie. But we are really looking forward to catching up with you later in your post-Amelie viewing to see what you think of the Frenchest film to ever French, I think it's fair to say.
Great. See you on the other side.
Talk soon.
That's it for the preamble, so here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory. Cool, so welcome back, and we have Cahen in studio here with us. After having finally seen the full title, Le Faible Destiné d'Amélie Poulain, or in English, Amelie. So as we always begin, Cahen, can you give us, and I think this is going to be kind of challenging, a quick summary of the plot?
It's about a city known as Paris. It's about a young woman who, after the death of Diana, gets started on some sort of mission of kindness, which to kind of this kind of invisible hand kind of thinking, where she tries to help people secretly, but then she kind of fancies someone, so then she kind of contrives it for them to meet in an overly convoluted way. And then in the middle of it, she gaslights this guy for an extended period. And yep. And then in the end, they fall in love. Spoilers.
That was a great summary. I feel like for a film that really takes a lot of twists and turns and throws in kind of superfluous moments maybe to the plot.
There's a lot of character vignettes and then there's a lot of like sensory moments and whatever. But I actually think the overall plot, as illustrated there, is relatively simple if you're trying to be like, what happens? But that's not why I think this film is so beloved. It's the way it makes you feel.
This is it.
I was wondering when I was watching it if the French felt the same way about it as we do about your leap years, your PS I Love Yous, your Wild Mountain Times. But my understanding is French people liked this film. French critics did not.
Oh, I did not.
It didn't make Cannes. And also that the idea that they never forgave Audrey Tautou, who is Amelie, who is the prototypical French gamine who this film launched her, that they never forgave her for becoming a movie star, this idea, and that she needs to be, you know, she needed to be suffering and doing challenging work to join the pantheon of your Deneuve's, your Huppert, or whatever, to be like a grand dame of French cinema. And then like she did The Da Vinci Code, and then she did, oh, is it Pretty Young Things or something? It was a Stephen Frears film that did really
Dirty,
well.
Pretty Things.
Yes, yeah. That was it. I'm crazy rich Asians. Who knows?
Damn, yeah. Three word titles.
But she's not, like, this was obviously absolutely massive. And then she became the face of Chanel. And that was almost as big, I feel. And then I think she never really, she's still, you know, around, but I feel like she didn't have a Marion Cotillard, shall we say, type career. But I wonder how, and also she had no interest in moving to the United States, which, you know, I understand.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd all rather live in France.
Back. Yeah. Yeah.
Next up, France for David.
Who knows?
Going around Montmartre, live in a little cafe. I can see this for you.
No,
I can see this for you.
But it's funny, Kane, I, like, when you mentioned there the Lady Di kind of catalyst nearly at the beginning of the story, or I was surprised because I'd forgotten that, like, it had been years since I'd seen it, and especially in the past year, I feel like the resurgence in Diana dialogue, it was like actually really apt feeling kind of to watch it again.
Yeah, definitely.
One thing that really stood out to me was how visually it stood the test of time so well, because
it is an incredibly well-crafted film, which, like, it is extremely difficult to make a Millefeuille. Like, there's so much in here, and it's so beautiful, and there's so much happening. I think it's actually easy to write it off as whimsical and not appreciate the technical craft that's in there.
Like, moments where objects around your house that were like animals, that
the
were
magical,
like,
realism where they start talking to
and
her.
When she's looking at, like, the passport photo where, like, the four different characters are speaking back. Like,
yeah,
there
that's
things made that almost
Matthew Kasovitz, I think, that happens to him. And then there's when she turns into a pillar of water and like, splashes all over.
But things that almost look like animation, but done really, really well integrated. That
And it is interesting, like you said, with the, because I actually remembered incredibly little about this film. I remember the kind of general look and feel, and I remember the gnome thing being much bigger than it was, because I think I saw this in or around when it first came out, or maybe a few years after it first came out. It's much sadder than I remember it being. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's quite sad. Like, obviously, you know, it comes together at the end, but it is much sadder than I remember it being.
Yeah, that was the thing I was surprised by. Again, the two things I, because the gnome thing was the thing I knew about going in, and then I was like, oh, this doesn't take up very much.
I don't know what, because, like, it was interesting that we both had that same impression, and I had seen the film whatever 2 decades ago and you hadn't, and we were both like, it's a film about a gnome, which was interesting. But even, like, from the beginning, the idea of a child slung between a neurotic and an iceberg is beautifully written, but also so sad. And that the reason that they homeschool her and keep her so protected is that she's so excited because she is never hugged or loved, that when her father, who is a doctor, is giving her a checkup, she's so excited to be touched by him that her heart is beating too fast. And, like, God, it's just incredibly sad. And what, like, a lonely... And then that her mother is killed by a suicidal Quebecois who jumps off Notre Dame. Like, it's all... You know, and it is very French, because there is, within 15 minutes, you see her parents having sex, her having sex, and a montage of people orgasming all over Paris. Mm-hmm. So there is, sex and death is very much present in, you know, the great stalwarts of French cinema are very much there.
Actually, one thing, if both of you were to do your own character intro, because I feel every time a character appears on screen in the movie, you're usually given, like, the name, this person likes this thing, this person dislikes this thing.
Oh, God, yeah, so, these tiny little moments.
If putting you on the spot here... If you were to say what would be your like and dislike intro, what would you go for?
Oh, I feel like mine would be, I like jumpers and I dislike chocolate.
Oh, interesting. Well, I mean, we're gonna pivot back to that.
Kate, what would yours be?
Oh, probably like loves the smell of fresh bread, hates men walking around with their hands down their pants.
Fair. I think I would have to go for likes a well-organized spreadsheet and dislikes asparagus.
And has, if anyone hasn't seen David's Oscar spreadsheet, it is
testament to that. By this stage, we'll have released our Oscar special episode where I will have shared it with the public.
So, yeah, come back to Amelie. Part of the inherent sadness of her father after her mother dies is he always wanted to travel and we couldn't travel because of your heart. So there were no trips to Italy. And she gets out of that house when she turns 18. I think you're not told, I think, specifically where the parents are. I think the idea is they're in the suburbs of Paris, and then she moves into Montmartre to work in the Du Moulin, the two windmills cafe, where you meet this cast of characters between the staff. I love that they have, like, an in-house tobacconist, because that's how much French people smoke.
Yep.
You know, the in-house tobacconist, the waitress who works with the owner of the cafe, and then the regulars. You have a absolute psychopath and you have a writer who seems quite nice. And then everyone is, as David said, like, introduced in this sort of very, like, short vignette way, and they all have great faces. There's amazing faces.
And also alongside all of the cafe staff and patrons, the people in the building that she lives in as well were introduced to a few of those. And one character in particular, Mrs. Wells, who is this woman who her husband left her years ago.
She's the concierge of the building.
To say that she is bringing the Jennifer Coolidge energy to this movie, I was like, I felt like I was watching a French remake of The White Lotus. It was like, she really embodies that, like, same energy of it.
I kind of forgot about her as well, because she's introduced quite early, and then you don't really see her as much as like the cafe people, and even the other great character, and this is the glass man, who is, I think, are they in the same building, or I can't, or is he in the building across the way, because they can look into each other,
like a courtyard situation.
Yeah, exactly, but I'm not sure if it's an internal courtyard or whatever, so it might be the same building. But anyway, they're neighbors, and he has a condition where his bones are extremely brittle, so he stays inside and paints impressionist paintings, or his versions of impressionist paintings, and he becomes the father substitute, which is what I came away with having watched it, because her own dad is so lacking. And she, well, actually, we should probably talk about the gnome, because we've mentioned it several times. Her father's great obsession is building a shrine for his dead wife's ashes, and for some reason, much like Carrie choosing to wear like a 50 grand gown and sprinkle Big's ashes out of an Eiffel Tower purse.
And there's a scene on said bridge as
Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, which is another classic French film. But they, for some reason, he puts a gnome on top of this shrine that he has built for his wife's ashes that was given to him when he was an army doctor. I think he retired from the army.
And worked in a spa then.
Yeah, but I think it might have been spa in the sense of like rehabilitation for soldiers spa, rather than like the original, like
cosmetic
a spa town, rather than let's all go to Monarch kind of situation. So
Daddy Amelie's given the Botox. Yes.
Yeah, I think that would be far too frivolous. But yeah, Amelie takes this, in order to encourage her father to see the world, she chisels this gnome off the tomb of her mother in the dead of night and gives it to an air hostess friend of hers whose cat she minds when she's flying. And yeah, I was a bit like, this is serious friendship, because that it's enormous. It's not like a handbag gnome. And then she takes photos of him at, you know, hotspots all over the world, and these photos are being mailed to the dad, who's obviously extremely confused.
I always liked the idea that she was bringing that gnome with her on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, so in her, like, and you've seen how small those bags our air hostesses have. Like, it's not a carry-on.
That needs to be handled like a sitch. Like, and then it's revealed at the end that she's willing to continue doing it because she's already got the nickname Snow White.
Yeah, which, I mean, understandable. I think we'd all be on that page.
I feel like everyone in this movie has committed themselves to at least a life of one nickname, at least.
Yeah. It's a long list of people who've truly committed to their bit, whatever their bit may be.
One other character pair of characters that we haven't mentioned is the grocer and the...
His grocer's assistant.
Yes. Which... That, it's something, again, kind of with a, like, 2020s lens, rewatching that, like, ooh, that kind of made me uncomfortable.
It's the only non-white character, again, in Paris. But I think there is something relatively true to light in it, is that I would say he's Maghrebin, or he is ethnically Arab, and he's being bullied relentlessly by his white boss. So there is something in the history of Paris that would, like, tie in with that as well. And I do think they kind of touch on it but don't go into it. I think he probably has some sort of intellectual disability or similar.
Well, I think even it's one of those situations where subtitles, I was running on subtitles, my French wasn't at the level where I could tune to just dialogue alone.
The subtitles aren't perfect, I would say.
And that was something that stood out to me, that there is a scene in which the grocer refers to him as a spastic. And that, as a word, I remember in the US has very different, like, socially accepted connotation versus here, where it is treated far more as a pejorative that kind of thing. That, in seeing that on the subtitles, like, definitely jumped out at me, and like how harsh the grocer was. And he does get his comeuppance in the end.
Yeah. It's actually, I think it's kind of interesting, his comeuppance is just one of those things. This is one of the surprises I had from watching it, where I was like, oh, as you're saying, like, It's a surprisingly sad movie. Like, I was expecting something really, like, sweet. And
I think it's sold to you as something that is whimsical, but I think a lot of the whimsy is in how it's crafted, whereas the storyline is... And also, she is, in the promotion or the pictures or whatever, she's framed as, like, a manic pixie dream girl, but she's not really, because she's very sad and depressed, and she's also very repressed, and like you touched on, she takes this guy that she fancies on this, like, madcap journey, but when it comes to talking to him without the help of her substitute father, the glass man, like, she can't do it. She can't. And he's basically telling her that she needs to commit to being happy, which she's spending so much time doing frivolous things, but the actual work of happiness is beyond her, understandably, because of the upbringing she had.
And so that's what I think is interesting about, like, the revenge on this guy, because she does it earlier to someone else who's, when she's a kid.
Oh yeah, she, a neighbor.
Yeah. Her neighbor tells her.
She was given a camera,
and her neighbor tells her, this is like a truly horrific thing to tell to a child. She's out taking photos, and there's a car accident, and her neighbor tells her that she caused the car accident with her camera, and like really tells her very like full performance of it.
Commits
and then she's sitting in watching the news and thinks she's called. Called the crash of the Hindenburg or whatever. Yeah. And then she realizes that he was making fun of her and then extracts revenge by messing with his sport, David. So I'm sure you are very sympathetic. You're very sympathetic with it. The one thing I would say is like, I think a lot of the other things she does, like let's say trying to matchmake people, trying to get her father to travel, you can kind of see the purpose in what she's doing. Whereas I don't really see how the greengrocer would put together the stuff that's happening in his apartment with being, I should stop being so horrible to my assistant, if you know what I mean.
Well, that's kind of the thing. But that's the thing with the other guy where it's just like, it's revenge and there's you're right, there isn't a moment where the greengrocer at the end kind of realizes the mistake he's doing. She's just relentlessly doing it.
Because with the neighbour, I get that he did a one-off thing to her that wasn't great and she's just like lashing out childishly and it's revenge. Whereas you feel like everything else kind of has a purpose and a journey. Yeah. Whereas I don't see how, like, you know, getting his lamp to explode is going
but
to
be. But it almost felt like it was an effort to make the gaslighting thing of making him feel crazy. And the comeuppance would be eventually to get him like committed to an asylum. That nearly felt like the vibe she was going for, of just like get him out of society and break him.
I do think it's also that kind of thing. It's the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory thing in the movie where the first one, they add that bit where Charlie tastes something and they go up to the
The fizzy lifting drink.
Yeah, and there's like the directors of that was like, well, Charlie can't be good the entire time. Like he literally just makes, he earns the factory by doing nothing for the whole thing other than
by being
like,
passively angelic. Yeah.
I hope those don't have a song for me. So I think it's important just for keeping her just on like, oh, she's not just like, as you're saying, like with the idea that she'd be like a manic pixie dream girl, that she has various layers and there's darkness there and there's sadness and loneliness. It's like even the idea that she wouldn't just confront the greengrocer, she'd go through this elaborate system of.
But even, I suppose, what she has been, her secret life of revenge and the various other things she's been doing, leads her to, I think, have the confidence to have that come back at him, where like he couldn't be an artichoke because artichokes have hearts. You know, where she was like, she would never have said that before. So I think it is growing into herself. And it's like, there's a great line in it by one of the sex shop workers where her love interest works along with the fun fair and along with, he has lots of nixers, where it's times are hard for dreamers. And I think that's what the whole, that's the crux of the whole film, really.
What actually I do love about the sex shop bit is that, because I didn't realise it was set in Mount Mart, which I don't, have you ever been there?
Years back,
yeah. That I didn't, it was watching, it was kind of like, isn't this just a massive like red light district? Yeah. It's like, it's not as whimsical and childlike and wholesome as
it has become much more so. I think like originally, obviously, it was the red light district, whereas now you do have this sort of juxtaposition of these two things that live alongside each other.
Yeah. And they've commercialised the historical aspect of it.
And the Moulin Rouge is there as well.
Exactly.
Which I went to once, which was quite fun. It was like Eurovision, except topless.
Hey!
And again, like with the, that they have a peep show in this sex shop. So again, like there's boobs.
Yeah.
And also like it is done in a way where like it doesn't feel particularly like voyeuristic or creepy or whatever. Yeah. But at the same time, it was like, there is more nudity in this film than there needed to be, but it's France. So. Yeah.
And actually, it's funny you mentioned the Moulin Rouge as well, because the scenes in the film Moulin Rouge, where it's kind of going through Montmartre in the opening. Yeah,
they have that very great long tracking shot. Yeah.
And the kind of hyper speed sequences through it. Yeah. There were moments of that I felt really reminded me of the way Amelie was shot.
Is a really kinetic film. There is an awful... And also, again, I am not sure, and again, because perhaps the French critics didn't like it and it committed the cardinal sin of being an international smash, it is the technicality of it is incredible.
Stunning.
Like, those shots are amazing.
But that's like the emotion of that, like his storytelling and the kind of capture, getting you in a frenzy nearly kind of thing.
It's a very kinetic movie. Yeah, like things are always moving. And I think it's balanced. It's interesting because looking at it, it starts, so you have you still have obviously tracking shots throughout the film, but it's very fast paced in the start. Then you have like these moments of, you know, oh, you're putting your hand in a bag of grain and it's very sensory and whatever. But then as the movie develops and the stories develop or whatever, the sequences are longer, the edits are less Scorsese chop, chop, chop-esque. You know, so it is, it's really craft. It kind of, and it almost slightly deliberately sells you down the river that you think you might be getting a certain type of film where it's, you know, wild and whimsical. But it actually becomes more and more, as she enters the real world through doing all these things, it actually becomes more of a traditional storytelling where you have like longer sequences and you have, you know, characters actually talking to each other and things like that. And you still have, like we said, the touches of magical realism or whatever with like pictures talking to you and stuff like that. But it becomes a more traditional film the longer it goes on.
I actually wondered if it was one of the first times when I was watching it that you start seeing CGI kind of wandering into like comedies or like dramas and things like that, because it's very visually. It's also kind of funny just because I guess because other filmmakers these days, if they're doing something like this, if it was like Wes Anderson or like Michel Gondry doesn't make most stuff anymore, but they'd always go for like the homemade in-camera effect of this is very happy to go like we can use CGI here, but it's in a
But I think fun. It's still in the spirit of, so you mentioned Michel Gondry there. I did my French language thesis was comparing the cinema of Georges Méliès to Michel Gondry, kind of looking at the lens of magical realism or whatever. So the French have a massive tradition of that starting with Méliès. So I think you're right in what you're saying where it's like a nod to that, but then it's also updated as well, whereas Gondry very much, who would have been like around that time, would have been making work, but it was very much that sort of like the more in-camera practical effects as well.
And in terms of the kind of acts of kindness that Amélie performs, where do you respectively stand on the morals of that kind of sentence?
I would be... It's kind of one of those things where it's probably not like the best behavior. I think it's just because it's stuff like where it starts out as a small thing of like leading that guy to open the box. But then it starts when you start getting... When she kind of goes matchmaking between the two people in the cafe, even though that guy is clearly one of the most horrible people on Earth.
Well, I think she kind of learns that. So basically, one of the waitresses in the cafe is pretty much stalked by her ex, who sits there and talks into a dictaphone about various things that she's doing, which she assumes she's shagging all around her and whatever. And if she was, she's entitled to, because they're not together. So Amélie, and I think in a sort of innocent way, thinks that the obvious solution is to pair him with someone else, with the hypochondriac tobacconist, which is not a sentence I thought I would be saying. And initially it is successful and, you know, they're happy and whatever, but this man is who he is, as you were saying, and it becomes apparent that the problem is so he immediately starts his obsessive behaviour regarding her as well. So I think it is...
There's a sweet spot where it looks like it's going to go
But
well,
I think it is a... It just shows that she is quite innocent, you know, and then it's almost... I think there's almost a moral in that where it was like the problem was this guy. It was not anything else, you know.
You can only control situations to a certain degree. And I think as the film goes on, it becomes about her trying to organize her own romantic thing. Because I guess, as you're saying, the whole thing is about she's been emotionally distant by her own choice for her entire life. So it's like her trying to figure out how to do it, but she gets more frightened the closer it gets to an actual real thing.
Yeah,
totally. And even the fact that it's all communicating through this, like, posters around the place, and that there's no direct contact, it's all kind of indirect.
And I think it is interesting that she always fancied him from whenever she saw him or whatever. So it's not like she was doing this and fell in love with him through it. She's doing this because she doesn't know how to tell him or how to be like, do you want to get a drink sometime or anything like that.
I also like, even though I now realize whenever I start a new thing, it ends up being another character that gets mentioned. I do enjoy that the entire mystery of the photo booth man is one of those things where it's kind of like they're like, this is how you know they're suited, because they came up with the most imaginative idea of like who this bald man who keeps turning up in the photographs is. And it's like, is it a ghost, is it a thing? But it's like, then you find out who he is and it's like, oh, it's the guy who fixes it. That makes the most sense.
So Nino, who's played by Matthew Kassovitz, who I'd say most people might know from Le Hen, one of the other extremely different French films, he gathers the shredded passport photos that people might like come out of the passport booths and like discard and whatever for whatever reason, because we weren't in retake land at the time, and he has them in an album. And she gets hold of one of his albums and she's very taken to this. But there's this guy, this bald man, distinctive looking guy, who keeps appearing through it. And as you say, they've constructed, like, you know, incredible. Is he a ghost? Is he whatever? And it turns out that if you ring and say the booth is broken, he's the guy that comes to fix it. So, of course, he takes a photo of himself just to make sure it prints and whatever. And then, of course, he doesn't want it because he's not there to take a passport photo. So and in a way that was good, but it was also a really clever reason as well.
Yeah.
But it was very reality based, and that is kind of what happens where it is, and you know, and you kind of feel like the glass man as her substitute yeah. dad. Interestingly, she sends him videos of like kind of little moments, and I think he really is her father because it reminds me of me sending stuff off the internet and memes to my dad. Aww, so I think this is these videos are prototype memes that she sent. It's like, look, here's things from the world that you would like.
Yeah. But I think even the idea of the simplicity of the explanation of the photo booth is a real. It's a great juxtaposition of how much magical realism there is in the movie, because I think as a viewer you get caught up in it in a way that when that reveal comes you're like, oh okay, back down to earth, and it is you kind of forget that you've kind of got off on a bit of a tangent yourself thinking all these elaborate things.
I think he's the only one that has an expression that would be what you'd probably, if you met this eccentric group of characters, the only one that kind of goes like
what's up with all you guys.
Right. It was kind of just, it was interesting. I really enjoyed it. It was kind of one of those things that, I think sometimes I have a stupid thing when you watch like something that's beloved and you go like, and then you watch it and it's like, oh, this is the reason why people like
yes.
I think it can go, you can be, it goes either one of two ways where you're like this, people like this. And I do think, as you said, it's aged very well. Maybe some of that is technically, but also if it was as light and fluffy and whimsical as it is pitched as being, or we remember it being, I don't think it would still resonate and last the way it did. I think the reason that it does is there is a real melancholy to it. And I think that's it. And also, like, I think the idea of loneliness, and especially urban loneliness, is something that even after the past 2 years is even more resonant. And then the idea of community as well.
Yeah. It was even like when I think you touched on it earlier, which I really enjoyed, was the how sensory everything is.
Yes, massively.
Like she really kind of just feels everything and kind of, and I know it's those cliches where you watch things and you want like, oh, I'd like to go on holiday again because I haven't been able to leave my house for 2 years. But it's just like, it was one of the things where it was such a subjective camera kind of thing. Like everything is, you're seeing everything through her eyes, and it's kind of like,
And it could be argued that she's neurodivergent as well, that she just processes the world in a different way. And then I definitely think in terms of what you're saying, that it is obviously an incredible advertisement for Paris. And that was part of the criticism, was that it was too sanitized and that there, you know, graffiti and stuff is, and whatever is gone, and then obviously that it is an extremely white Paris as well. So these are the arguments of the times, but I think it is very, like, I think there's a reason that you can, you know, do Amelie tours and things of Montmartre. And also I think it is, even though, as we were saying, it is more resonant than you would imagine, but I think it is like the whimsy or whatever that like draws people, you know, it's like, oh, I'm, you know, that I want to go to Paris and I want to, you know, live in the world of Amelie or whatever.
But it's saying there's an undercurrent of melancholy and sex throughout the whole thing. That's just like, oh, it's even like, I think one of my favorite scenes in it, even though I'm not 100% sure how to feel about it, is the when she's on the ghost train and she's kind of just floating. It's just really like, weirdly, like, sensual moment in a not particularly sensual film.
I think it is a very sensual film in the sense of sensory, yes, but I don't think it's a particular... Like
the intimacy kind of, like that,
Yeah, exactly, and I think she is someone who, like, struggles with intimacy, as you say, because it's been in no way healthily mapped for her during her growing up, where, like, I could think of watching that ghost train thing, being like, I would punch that man so hard.
Oh, yeah, if that actually happened.
So her love interest among, as we said, he has many, many... kooky Nixers around Montmartre, but he is one of the characters in the ghost
train. One of the creepers.
Yeah, is that what they're called?
That's what I call them.
He's kind of like, he's kind of like the prototypical like manic pixie dream boy. Like he doesn't have much of an inner life as far as
yeah, and he doesn't even talk very much as well. And like each job he has is, you know, like, you know, like dildo pricer upper and living skeleton on the ghost train or whatever.
Not the guy you bring home to mom and dad as much.
Her dad is finally gone traveling and her mother is squashed. So she doesn't have that issue.
She's not concerned.
I actually just remembered one of the characters in it that somehow, again, there's a million characters.
It's a rich tapestry.
I do love the, you know, the bit when she is kind of going searching for the original man and she meets the older couple and the husband keeps talking about like, oh, she's going to tell you I'm senile. Just, I like the kind of lived in for like, again, for all like the whimsy and stuff and how like tightly art directed it is. There is still like a lived in-ness to all of it. And like they still, most of them still feel like actual characters.
And I think
like,
some of it is also, it's the way they look, to touch back on what we were saying, the very beginning, they have incredible faces, but they do look like real people, as opposed to...
It's not a Hollywood polish.
And they don't all look like Audrey Tautou. And we couldn't, let's face it, no one else can pull off that haircut. You know,
it's an impeccable
I'm sure many tried.
Don't try me. I will try it.
You know, I respect you in all of your endeavours, David. This may take a while also for you to grow.
I could almost do it.
Yeah, I actually feel like you're probably closer to that.
Maybe I'll get a wig. Yeah. But so we usually ask as well, so you did mention enjoying it. Would you watch it again?
Yeah, in fact, I watched it twice before I came here.
That's the level of dedication that we appreciate.
Would you further commit to it and watch the musical adaptation? So it opened in 2015, I believe, in the US.
Mm, I was wondering if you'd seen it, actually, David.
No, it opened in London in 2020 and was shut down, obviously, with COVID, and then I think it's reopened since. But it's definitely something I would love to...
I get how it would work, because there's certain things that become musicals and you're a bit like, huh. Mm. And obviously it's not a jukebox musical, which is kind of the big thing at the moment, where it's like Mamma Mia being the obvious example, where it's like you get all the songs of an artist and build a plot around it. So like, this is the opposite, where you take kind of the property and build songs through. But I suppose, like that other great French classic, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Le Parapluie de Cherbourg, which is an extremely depressing musical. But I feel like the French have form in this, where a musical doesn't necessarily need to be, you know.
Well, I think, like, the fact that it's an English language musical. Given I love subtitles, I hate dubs. I feel like watching a musical of Amelie spoken through English would be almost like watching a dub in a way. But
then again, I do think it is, like, I've been to an opera where they had subtitles, which was really helpful, because obviously, like, I know jack shit about opera, and it was like, was it Die Fledermaus, which is basically involves a man dressing up as a bat. It's not one of those ones that, you know, might be based on mythology or might even be like Carmen or something that you have an idea.
And it's nothing to do with a future Robert Pattinson film as well.
I mean, same vibes.
Yeah.
Batman the musical.
I went to see Spider-Man the musical in New York. Much maligned Julie Taymor
was
one.
Was there any...
I genuinely loved it.
Like, yeah, I've heard... I think the problem was... much like kind of Titanic or whatever, it became this white elephant that so much money had been thrown at.
Injuries, there were so many injuries. And like, I think people, they were having trouble like getting people to sign up to be understudies. Yeah.
It's actually probably closer to Ben-Hur, where you're like, people died to bring you this.
Yeah,
but it would have been worth it though.
I loved it. The music was, a lot of it was written by Bono and the Edge.
Yes.
Yeah. And Reeve Carney was the lead when I saw it. And he's since gone on to do a number of acting.
My closest experience to maligned Broadway adaptations, as I saw in Cork, they did when the local colleges did Carrie the musical.
Oh, fine.
I'm not sure I knew they'd made a musical out of that.
It's kind of weird.
I can see it as a play, actually, because almost that feeling of claustrophobia and stuff could work really well as a play. But again, like, can things just be plays? They don't need musical numbers? No, maybe?
Well, it's kind of fun to see, like, a bucket of blood to people going like,
Or it's like the Avengers musical that they put in Hawkeye, which is 100% going to exist as a thing.
Crossies.
Yeah, but it was... I thought that was really well done, because it was actually very funny, and it was that idea of, like, why are we doing a dance number of the, you know, destruction of New York City?
That does remind... What's my favourite moment in one of the Oscars over the years was when Crash was up for best song, and they just had like loads of people dancing in front of flaming cars. Like, we're dancing about how racism is bad.
Okay.
We all crash into each other.
Yeah, dance will solve it. I actually remember speaking of 9/11 musicals, in Skins, they had one.
Oh gosh, yeah.
As well.
Yeah. That.
Yeah.
Skins was quite a show.
Yeah. But, and so, well, I think it's time for us to jump over to my personal favourite segment. Andy, cue the music. What's in the box? Yes, it's What's in the Box. So this is our segment where I go through my archives to try and find something related to the film under discussion. And what I have this week is my photocopy of the sheet music of the Amelie soundtrack. Because at the time when I got this is a pre-internet era when I was learning music, the soundtrack wasn't available to purchase in Ireland. The rights or whatever, it wasn't available. So someone I know had gone to France, also music student, had bought the soundtrack in a shop over there, and I photocopied the whole thing. So I did learn the main theme tune, which is called Comptine d'une autre été, And yeah, that was a brief foray that I had into the world of film music.
And it is a slightly, not obviously pre-internet 20 years ago, but the idea that you had to go to France, buy the thing, bring it back, photocopy it, you know. Yeah.
There was a great community around it. I
had a friend of mine in college who took a photograph of a piece of music that he needed. Mm. But it was like when it was just like, you know, button phones and things like that.
Okay.
Button phones. And he put it in his pocket and for some reason my number came up, so he just kept sending me the same thing. I tried ringing him, but it didn't, like, I basically got 20 euros.
Oh God, and you had to pay to receive.
Oh, yeah.
It was really funny. It was like, but the worst part was the photograph wasn't even clear enough that you could actually play it. I couldn't figure out what it was.
It must have been like having a ghost in your phone that was sending anything over it. So there's one last question that we do like to ask before we wrap things up, and obviously this is the last one to see about films that you feel everyone except you has seen. To spin it, is there any film that you particularly enjoy that you feel not enough people have seen?
Okay. Well, I was kind of thinking about this on the way, where, because since MLA is a movie where it's a sweet movie with an undercurrent of darkness, I've decided to go with a dark rom-com with an undercurrent of sweetness, which is Elaine May's A New Leaf from 1971, which... it is about a aging bachelor, very aging. He's in his mid-50s.
Well, he might as well be dead.
Matthew, played by Walter Matthew. And he's run out of money. And he decides what he needs to do is to marry somebody. And he kind of finds someone who falls in love with him. And then they get married. And then he starts thinking about whether he should murder her or not, so that he wouldn't have to go get a job, because that seems to be what she's implying. And then it's about how he kind of comes around to her. And I know describing this out loud makes it sound like it's horrible, but it's really funny, and it's kind of sweet, but it's also just like, it's filled with just very funny dialogue, and everyone in it is very good, and it's fun. Elaine May didn't direct very many films. I think it was only 4, and this was her first one. And it's very, very good. I watched it about a year ago, I think, for the first time. And it was just like, it was one of those movies I was like, where has this been all my life? Kind of one.
Cool. I'm going to stick in our world and say, you could check out A Very Long Engagement, which is Audrey Tautou's other film with Jean-Pierre Jeunet. And we touched on it earlier, but if you want a less idealized Paris, you could go with Nino, who's Matthew Kassovitz for La Haine. But the one that I would recommend is the French title is Jeux des Enfants, which is the children's games. But the English title that they gave was Love Me If You Dare, which is Marion Cotillard and her, even though they were not together during the film, they got together later, her life partner, Guillaume Canet, who's also a show jumper, which came as a surprise. I mean, the French, is there nothing they can't do? And this is this is a film where from their childhood through their adolescence into their 20s, they have a ever escalating game of sort of truth or dare, cap by cap, where they're handing this kind of musical box back and forth between each other. And obviously the stakes are forever getting higher. It interferes with them, you know, living in the real world. So I think it's definitely one that is worth watching.
Excellent. And my recommendation stays in the world of French cinema. And as I mentioned, there was aspects of Amélie that I loved that bordered on animation. So this one was released in 2002, I believe, over here. And 2003, sorry. It was released in the UK and Ireland under the title Belleville Rendezvous. US, the triplets of Belleville, and the French title, the original, was just a direct translation of that, Les Triplets de Belleville. But it's a story of a Tour de France cyclist who is kidnapped by the French mafia, and his grandmother and 2 accomplices and a dog go on an adventure to rescue him. So a little bit all over the place. It was nominated for the best animated feature in...
And it's a very stylized type of... animation.
Yeah, the animation is something, it's definitely not your Disney look, and it has a real like hand-drawn art beauty to it.
And the soundtrack as well.
So the theme tune to it was recorded by an artist called M and was nominated for an Oscar as well that year. It's a stunning movie. I have it on DVD at home. And
I think it's also the most realistic dog I've ever seen in a cartoon. It's just one of those things where dogs get kind of Like, it has the personality of an actual dog you'd meet.
That yeah, just as like, opposed yeah. to an anthropomorphized yeah. animal.
I do actually, yeah. I mentioned, have the DVD and had looked. I was a big fan of all the making of and extra features back in the day on DVDs.
Who would have
I
thought it?
Do remember watching this one and seeing how the animators observed real animals and, like, were really, like, you can see it in the end product, just the level of detail and attention that they paid to all of that. So
I do think it is one of the great losses that, which, like, since everything's kind of moved over to streaming in a way that we kind of lost making ofs, because even if you get Blu-rays and DVDs now, they don't really make them anymore because they're like, ah, people aren't going to buy these.
Yeah, I've seen, like, a handful of things ending up on YouTube that even things that were DVD extra features, like the recent Batman animated series, the 1990s one that they put out a recent Blu-ray kind of collection box set of, it had a documentary that was called Heart of Batman that you can watch on YouTube for free.
Anyway, that's a story for another day. Thank you so much for coming in. I would like to apologise to any of our listeners, particularly any French listeners, for absolutely mangled pronunciations that may have happened during that. We did do our best.
Cool, thank you.
Well, what more can we say but merci beaucoup to Ethan for joining us for that. So there was a little clue, other than this week being the birth of the second series of Russian Doll, starring the protagonist of our film, there was a little Easter egg in your watching for our next film.
So in Heartstopper, when one of the characters is researching LGBT movies, he's like questioning his sexuality, he is going through this list that has the likes of Brokeback Mountain and Moonlight, but then up pops our selection for our next episode, But I'm a Cheerleader. So we have the wonderful Sarah Maria Griffin and Alan McGuire from the Juvenalia podcast coming on to tackle that one,
which is very exciting. And again, it's nice for us to do like a queer story, and we have a split in the camp here. You had seen the film and I had never seen it. I always think that's interesting to bring in, like we had it with obviously the Rocky Horror as well. There's actually a theme in the ones you've seen and I haven't, funnily enough. So I think that does bring an element as well when we're discovering it along with our guests. So I always really enjoy that. And this is our first duo as well, which is nice. Sarah and I do talk at a rate of absolute knots. So I'm just delighted there was also space for you and Alan in the word count.
We did manage quite well, because I believe that was recorded entirely remote, that episode.
Just trying to get the four of us in the same place at the same time was a struggle. I think you and I were in the studio.
Yes, we managed to do pretty well, I think, given remote management's always a little bit tougher than the in-studio.
And the longer Sarah and I talk, the faster we get. It's like one of those videotapes when it starts to spool out. So yeah, delighted to chat about that one. And God, Natasha's looking great, isn't she? All the content that they're dropping in and around Russian Doll, all the magazine covers she's doing, like the woman's art, she's amazing.
Fantastic, yeah. And also there is a re-release coming next month of All About Eve, which is a horror movie she did with Peaches Christ, who's a drag queen in San Francisco.
Is it genuinely called All About Eve? Because isn't that not the Bette Davis film?
Oh, sorry. No, All About Evil is the one. That's it. All of it.
Because I thought you said they're doing a re-release of All About Eve, and I was like, well, we're going to get Marco Donovan back in because he and I are going to see that.
No, All About Evil, I believe it's like the name, obviously, is a parody. Yeah. But yeah, there's a re-release of that coming next month as well, which I will be looking forward to seeing in restored quality.
It's Natasha's world and we are just living in it. I'm hearing good things about series 2 of Russian Doll as well. But haven't hit that up yet. I mean, David, just so many things to watch, so little time.
We will leave it at that and see you back here in 2 weeks' time.
Same bat time, same bat channel. Vive la France.
This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.